Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another great episode we have here of Crime and Science Radio with your hosts, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke. Today's show is called Deadly Doctors, Killer Nurses, and Other Medical Miscreants with special guest, B. Yorker. So now, everybody, here's your hosts, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome, everyone. We're pleased to be joined today by Beatrice Croft-Yorker, Dean of the College of Health and Human Services at Cal State University, Los Angeles, and one of the busiest women I know, so I really appreciate your being here. The college that over which she's dean is the one that includes CSULA's forensic science program. She's also known for her own research into Munchausen by proxy, her landmark study of medical serial killers, and her publications on other topics that bring law, psychology, medicine, and ethics together. So welcome to the program, Bea.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you. Well, we're so glad you could be here, and I wanted to go a little bit over your background just to sort of give our listeners an idea of, all the areas that you've studied in and to also find out from you how some of them came together. So you had an RN with a bachelor's degree in nursing. You went on to get a master's in nursing with a major in child and adolescent psychiatric nursing and a minor in education. And after you had those degrees in nursing, you returned to school to obtain a Juris Doctorate. So not everyone would consider a law degree as the next step after a master's in nursing. So what led you to follow that career path?
Well, it's a good time in my life. I was working in child psychiatry at a large general hospital in Atlanta, Georgia. And to my horror and surprise, about half of my caseload involved child abuse and or neglect. And then when I decided that I wanted to be a nursing professor, I knew I needed some type of a doctoral degree. They didn't have PhD programs in nursing in Georgia at the time. They do now. But after testifying in some fairly difficult child abuse cases, because I was the nurse that identified child abuse, I was very intrigued, and I thought, you know what, I will get a Juris Doctor degree and hope that I can be a nursing professor. And it worked out.
Hmm. Wow.
Well, one of your areas of expertise is the whole Munchausen syndrome, and most people probably know the name Munchausen from those silly movies. About Munchausen, who was a character, a real person. But in my 40 years of medicine, I've actually seen probably four or five cases of Munchausen, and two were Munchausen by proxy, and the other two or three were true Munchausen syndromes. And they're very, very, very odd syndromes. Can you explain to our listeners exactly what Munchausen and Munchausen by proxy is?
Certainly. So Munchausen syndrome is a psychiatric disorder where you make yourself sick for the purpose of getting medical attention. It is not malingering. Malingering is pretending that you're sick to get workers' comp or some other kind of benefits. It's not hypochondria, where you worry that you're sick, but you aren't really. Munchausen syndrome, you go so far as to actually trick doctors by faking medical results or even injecting yourself to the point of risking your life to really become ill. And it's because you want to be in the hospital, you want to get medical attention. By proxy is instead of making yourself sick, you make your child or a dependent who's in your care, you make them sick. And then you get a different kind of attention. You get attention for being the caregiver. of a critically ill person.
Yeah, it's almost like you make yourself a victim of the circumstance. I know, as a cardiologist, I one of the cases I had probably 15 years ago was a guy who visited hospitals around the West, and he would come in complaining of chest pain, and he had an absolute great story for what we call unstable angina. Well, you're kind of stuck with that as a cardiologist. You can't do stress testing because it's actually contraindicated in someone with a dangerous situation. So you end up taking him to the cath lab. And this guy had undergone cardiac catheterization a half a dozen times when I saw him in the emergency room, and his story was so good, we cathed him, and it was normal. And then started putting the pieces together because you don't have time then, but over the next week or so, realized this guy had done this in many hospitals up and down the West Coast. Weird, weird. What are some of the cases that you know about that would be interesting or would point out exactly what this syndrome is all about?
Well, this is a real case that happened when I was in Georgia. A nurse worked on the floor, and she passed out at work. So luckily, she was in a hospital. They rushed her down to the emergency room, and they did all kinds of lab tests, and they found out that her blood sugar was very, very low. So they pumped her full of, Bringer's lactate, some sugar water, and they said to her, you need to eat before you come to work. No, you can't be passing out with low blood sugar. So she said, okay. A couple of months later, she passed out at work again, and this time her blood sugar was so dangerously low that they said, oh, my gosh, her pancreas must have a tumor in it. It's overproducing insulin. We're going to take out her pancreas. So they took out her pancreas, sent it off to the lab. The pancreas was perfectly fine, and they said, well, at least we saved her life because obviously it was overproducing insulin. And a few months later, when she passed out at work with dangerously low blood sugar, that was when the doctors in the emergency room thought to themselves, maybe the insulin wasn't coming from her pancreas. Sure enough, she was using her patient's insulin, injecting herself with insulin to cause insulin shock.
Wow.
It's the exact, the first case I saw was when I was a junior medical student, was exactly that. It was a guy in the VA hospital who every morning would come in on rounds and he'd be in a coma and covered with, frosty sweat, and we'd check his blood sugar and it'd be 25. He was a known diabetic, so we adjusted his medicine. Then we worked him up for an insulinoma like what you're talking about, everything. And it took a couple of weeks, and we still didn't have an answer. And finally, one of the professors said, this has to be factitial, meaning that he's doing it to himself. We went and took his room apart, and sure enough, he had syringes and a bottle of insulin taped to the bottom of one of the drawers in his bedside table. And he was injecting himself every morning at 5:30.
I'm going to add your patient now to my lectures on Munchausen.
Hey, they're very clever. What makes people do this? I mean, what's the psychodynamic? What predisposes people to this? What is it? I mean, obviously there's a payoff with attention, but there's something deeper than that. What's going on here?
There is. And as a nurse who's worked in pediatrics, we know that the typical child is terrified of being admitted to the hospital. They protest, they cry, they cling to their parents. It is not a happy situation. Every once in a while, we see a child that gets admitted to the pediatric unit, and that child thrives. They're happy as can be. They're sitting on the nurse's lap. They're playing in the nurse's stations. And you just sort of wonder, what is going on at home that this child is so happy to be here in the hospital with us?
Hmm. And the parent is getting what out of this?
Well,
and why are they doing it? Obviously, the child's the innocent victim here.
So that's how people may make themselves sick. What happens is they come in accidentally into the hospital. They realize it's a happy, good place compared to the rest of their lives. So then they keep trying to get themselves back in that nurturing setting. And then for a parent, for them to cross over, it's even more complicated because sometimes when a parent is facing criticism, like let's say their in-laws
are saying, oh, you're not a very good parent, or, you know, we're upset with the way that you're raising your little Johnny. Well, nobody criticizes you if your child has some deathly illness. All of a sudden, the family is very supportive, and all the criticism of you as a parent goes away. And also, you get all this attention when your child is in the hospital, just like you may have gotten if you made yourself ill in the past. And what we have found, and what I have found in dealing with the mothers who have done this, is that the vast majority of them started out making themselves ill before they moved on to making their children ill.
That's interesting, and it makes sense. I wasn't aware of that. That's interesting, and it does make sense. You get your own attention, and you realize you need something else, and you come off as the caring hero if you're worrying over your child. Interesting. How common is this? I mean, is this something that's rare as hen's teeth, or does this really happen more than we think?
It's pretty rare. The rare part is when you are an active inducer, meaning that you would inject a child with insulin or smother a child. What is more common is parents who just lie, okay? Parents who fabricate. That, I think every single pediatric facility sees parents who exaggerate, who get hysterical, who worry, and they may not actually be harming their child other than the fact that they are subjecting their child to over-medicalization and to making the child worry about their health. But the serial nurse murderers is extremely rare. I'm going to say one in a million caregivers. So, you know, even though there are quite a few documented cases, I don't want people to worry that when they go in the hospital, they might be a victim.
So with the Munchausen system syndrome by proxy parent, what can hospitals do to recognize that and prevent that parent from further harming their child?
One of the first things, and I'm very excited about the Affordable Care Act, and about the ability to have single and electronic medical records. One of the biggest ways that Munchausen parents get away with it is they doctor shop. And so now that we're working to have medical records follow patients, it'll be a lot harder when a mother takes a child to the hospital and the doctors say, there's nothing wrong with your child, or the doctor say, well, we're concerned about this, but here are the steps to take, or here's the medicine the child's on. Then they can't surreptitiously or sneakily go around the back and go to another doctor and start all over again and get a whole different group of medications. Mm. So, I think electronic medical records, tracking everybody with single payer or one provider is really going to help people pay attention to this.
What are some of the legal issues that get associated, you know, with trying to say even once you're past the issue of, say, the child being placed in a safer environment? What are the legal issues that are involved, and how difficult is it to prosecute this kind of parent? And also, I'm assuming that hospitals and medical providers need to be aware of liability issues here as well.
They do. It's a horrible, difficult, sticky situation to try and prosecute. First of all, it's counterintuitive to child abuse. Anytime you report suspected child abuse, you're thinking of somebody that's smacking the kid, hurting the kid, bruising the kid, something that visibly harms the kid. It's just completely foreign to our understanding when you say, we've got a mother that's killing with kindness. You know, this mother is taking such good care of the child that they're being over medicated or overtaken to the hospital or over attended to. And one of my articles that I wrote when I was working with Munchausen was on the legal issues of putting hidden cameras in hospital rooms. And my research shows that there's no legal right to privacy in a hospital room. As a matter of fact, we expect that doctors and nurses would be monitoring children all the time just in case they stopped breathing. And so as long as you put signs up in the hospital that say, you know, this hospital uses moving pictures or cameras for the patient, it's the safety of our patients, then that's a really effective way of catching parents who are active inducers, who smother or inject or poison their children. Or in one case that I saw, a mother disconnected the IV line and let the child bleed so that they were, you know, they had almost bled to death in the hospital. So the cameras, that's, you can do that. It's just very expensive for hospitals to set that up.
Yeah. Then you're also talking about monitoring them as well, making sure someone's watching them. Yeah. So, you know, to just kind of, you had mentioned a little earlier about, you know, that we shouldn't be fearful that the vast majority of people in hospitals are killers, or that it's a small number of medical serial killers. So, at the same time, I think part of what shocks people is realizing, you know, if you want to talk about people that have the means and all of this, of course, one of the most prolific serial killers of our time was Harold Shipman. He's just an English country doctor. He got sentenced for 15 murders, but when he was investigated in the UK, in about 2004, they thought the number was probably closer to at least 217, probably higher considering the length of time he'd been working for quite a long time. And you've done some studies that show that there have been cases also, you know, probably more than we would imagine in the United States. But how prevalent are they?
The
whole problem?
The good news is that in the United States, the number of new cases is tapering off. So what happened is in the 1970s, there are some historical healthcare serial killers. Okay, so throughout history, people have recognized that every once in a while you have a rogue doctor or a rogue nurse, and they're able to get away with it, like you said with Dr. Shipman, because when you have sick and dying patients, death is not unusual. And so that in and of itself makes the whole thing harder to detect. But in the 70s, there were about 8 cases of prosecutions of nurses for serial murder of patients. Then in the 80s, that number increased to about 15, and then in the 90s, it got even higher. There were like 25 or 30 prosecutions, and then ever since the 2000s, there have been fewer and further between, and I attribute this to safeguards in hospitals, such as a Pyxis machine, which dispenses every single dose of narcotics as well as routine medications. So, you know, that's kind of the good news. In Europe and in other first world countries, unfortunately, there are more cases of healthcare providers who are being arrested and prosecuted for suspected serial murder of patients. And again, I think that's because maybe they haven't caught on to the U.S. safeguards quite as much yet.
I'm just follow up a little bit on that. You know, one of my big concerns, I have to say, with looking at, the more I've become aware of what goes on in forensic science delivery in the U.S., is that death certificates are just so woefully inadequately filled out. They're often filled out by people who really actually have no medical training, in if they're coroners in a lot of jurisdictions. And also that even in hospital death certificates, you know, not always as fully as they could be. And we know that when people reach a certain age, which I would consider to be sort of in this vulnerable population, you're not going to get autopsied.
No.
Probably if you're over 50 in the U.S., unless there's blood all over the place.
Right, unless there's something that causes you to say this was an unexpected, unexplained death. But usually, if a person is in the hospital, it's de facto considered expected. I mean, that's a horrible thing to say, but people go, well, you were in the hospital, so, you know, you were in critical condition.
Exactly. I've signed many death certificates in my career, and, you know, and this is one of my favorite topics, is healthcare providers that do this. It drives me crazy, but and I hope I've never run across one unknowingly, but as a colleague or whatever, but you know, as a physician, if someone dies in the hospital, he signs the death certificate. 99 out of 100 times, the medical examiner coroner is not even going to look at that. He's going to say, fine, one less thing I have to worry with. And so physicians are in a unique position. I've always said the three most dangerous places on earth are an aircraft carrier deck during flight operations, a health food store, and a hospital. And you can get into all kinds of trouble at all three locations if you don't know what you're doing. There have been some very famous serial killers, both nurses and physicians. On the nurse side, there's people like Janine Jones and Charles Cullen and Richard Angelo. And on the physician side, there's the old wonderful Michael Swango, who gamed the system at hospital after hospital for many, many years. Can you tell us some of those are other cases that you are familiar with?
Well, let's see. Yes, there was a nurse in Florida and a nurse in England, both females, and they helped illustrate the link between Munchausen syndrome and nurses who are serial murderers. So the nurse in Florida was working in a nursing home. She'd moved from Illinois, and the nurse or the administrator that hired her in this nursing home talked to me after she was arrested, and she said, Bea, I knew this nurse was too good to be true. She would stay after her shift. She charted every bowel movement, every linen change. She seemed so dedicated. And then the Department of Public Health came to visit our little nursing home, and they said, you've had a 25% increase in the usual number of deaths on the night shift in your nursing home over the last 3 months. We're coming to investigate. And they were like, oh my gosh, how could that happen? During the investigation, this nurse who only worked the night shift, there was a fire in the clean utility room, and it turned out that the nurse set the fire. And then the nurse said she'd been assaulted in the stairwell, sexually assaulted. And on that investigation, it turned out that she had stabbed herself in the vagina with a pair of scissors to create what looked like a sexual assault. And then the Centers for Disease Control said, well, all of the suspicious deaths, all of the increase in deaths happened when she was on duty on the night shift. Then they found out that she was in the process of having her nursing license revoked in Illinois because her ex-husband had filed charges against her because her son had been brought to the emergency room several times over-medicated with psychiatric medications that had been prescribed for her. So she was clearly a Munchausen herself, a Munchausen by proxy to her son, And then when she moved out of Illinois down to Florida, all of a sudden her patients started dying.
We're going to take a quick break here, and then we'll be back and discuss this interesting topic further.
Welcome, everybody, after the break here again on another great episode of Crime and Science Radio. Today's show is called Deadly Doctors, Killer Nurses, and Other Medical Miscreants with very special guest, Bea Yorker. So now, here's your host, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome back. Bea, you were in the process of telling us about some fascinating case histories and with the nurse who had apparently managed to move from one location to another with jobs, and you had mentioned there was also an English case, so please tell us more about all that.
Okay, so Beverly Allitt was in nursing school in England, and she didn't do so well, so she had to repeat. She was so sick. She had many, many trips to the emergency unit, so she was delayed her graduation. Then she did get a job in a pediatric ward, and all of a sudden she got healthy, but this tiny little pediatric unit outside of London that usually had maybe two patients have a code a year, they had 26 codes in 6 weeks.
Wow.
So the hospital in London where these babies were being transported to said something terrible is going on at Grantham Hospital. Maybe it's a bad batch of drugs, you know, something terrible is going on. So then they started looking at, again, a typical epidemiologic investigation, who is on duty when these patients have a code. And they nailed it down to the new nurse, Beverly Allitt. So they suspended her, and as soon as she got suspended, she again started becoming critically ill. And she had injected the patients with insulin. They found, you know, like 10 times the normal amount of insulin. She'd injected patients with air. Believe it or not, on an autopsy, they saw an air embolus in one of the little babies. She had smothered another baby. She was so beloved by the parents and by her fellow nurses that one set of parents who'd had twins, they'd lost one twin because this nurse had injected the twin, but the surviving twin that had had a code and lived, they made Beverly Allitt the godmother of the surviving twin.
Oh, my God.
So then when she was arrested and in prison, she was in the emergency room for all kinds of complaints, including a breast lump, where it turns out she had injected her own breasts with normal saline to create breast lumps. She was so ill during the trial that there were some days that she couldn't even appear in court. Anyway, she was convicted of several of the baby's murders, and as far as I know, she is still in prison. But she really showed the link between her own Munchausen syndrome, where while she was in nursing school, she made herself sick so many times. She was crisscrossed with surgical scars on her abdomen. She'd had quite a few organs out, appendectomy, gallbladder. She'd had urinary retention where they'd given her catheters. And then once she started working as a nurse, she got well, but her babies started dying in the pediatric ward. So she's a great example. And then I love telling everybody about Richard Angelo. He is, I think, the only nurse who's, well, he and Cullen, two of the male nurses who have confessed. But Richard Angelo was fairly forthcoming. And so his confession gave me a lot of insight into why nurses do this. So what happened with Richard Angelo is that he worked the night shift. There'd been an increased number of codes, but the hospital hadn't really even figured it out yet. But after one of the patients was resuscitated, the patient gasped, opened his eyes, pointed at Richard Angelo, and he said to everybody around him after the code, he said, "That nurse just put something in my IV line that made me stop breathing." So that's when they arrested Richard Angelo. When he was in prison, he said that he injected his patients with things to make them stop breathing, because he got so much praise for performing well in a code blue. And he said, I did it because I got all this respect from my fellow nurses. He says, I'm like those firefighters who set fires. And that is what really illuminated for me, that these are people who like to create critical incidents. They do it for the drama. They do it for the excitement. And I was very privileged to get to meet the author of Serial Fire Setting. He has studied, 1,500 serial fire setters. And the dynamics are so similar to the serial healthcare killers. They like to create critical incidents.
Let me follow up on that. You know, Janine Jones, it was in Central Texas and worked for a pediatrician, and she would inject these kids with succinylcholine when they came in so they'd stop breathing, and then she would resuscitate them. But this happened so many times that the physician was actually in trouble with the county board, saying you must be doing something wrong. And in a very dramatic case, one of the children quit breathing, was really in trouble, and they got him resuscitated. They air-evac'd him from Kerrville, Texas, which is in Texas Hill Country, down to the hospital in San Antonio. And Janine Jones went along on the helicopter with the child, and the child actually quit breathing again during the flight because she injected the kid again during the flight.
Oh, my gosh.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Oh, my gosh.
Amazing. Amazing to me.
Yeah, I think this is also a good time to dispel a myth, because even in the articles, I know Doug and I have found some similar links to articles about these people, and quite often they'll be entitled something with the phrase Angel of Mercy in them, where there's this perception that these are people who are essentially assisting suicides, or see someone who's very ill and wants to, quote-unquote, end their suffering. Is that really, I mean, from what we're hearing so far, obviously not, but is that in any way part of what's going on here?
No, not at all. When we did our study, we excluded Jack Kevorkian because he is known as the Angel of Death. He did euthanasia. But the difference between Kevorkian and all of the nurses and doctors that I studied is that Dr. Kevorkian got informed consent from the patient and their family. And everybody said, we are asking Dr. Kevorkian to provide us with the tools so that we can choose to end suffering. Now, what's interesting, and I think Charles Cullen is one of the nurses who said, I was only trying to help my patients. They were suffering. Well, one of his patients came in for a biopsy that turned out to be negative. So you know that that is just complete bull, that this is just rationalizing. And again, these nurses are a train wreck of Axis II personality disorders. They are sociopaths. They are narcissistic. They are borderline personalities. And so they completely rationalize that what they're doing would have any benefit on their patients.
Right. So there is a whole different psychodynamic working here. This is not someone rational who decides to help someone. These are people with serious psychological problems, even if we don't always recognize people with these kinds of disorders walking among us. They are people who have really serious things going on, it sounds like.
Yes.
Stabbing yourself through a vagina with scissors doesn't mark you as somebody with problems, you know.
And
yeah.
It's sadistic. It is sadistic action, not compassionate action. You know, these are people who felt hatred, loathing, and contempt for both their patients and the other professionals that they worked with. And, so it was not in any way out of a place of compassion.
So where are people with these problems most likely to work? Are they going to be in hospitals or nursing homes or private nurses in individual homes? Where are they found?
They're found everywhere. So in our study, we did see that intensive care seems to be a place where they're pretty easily caught. And again, I attribute that to modern technology and also the ease, because you don't even have to stick a needle in a patient's skin. If you've got an IV line or two running, all you have to do is put a couple of millimeters extra of what would otherwise be a therapeutic medicine into an IV line, and you can kill somebody. So it's not surprising that there are a lot of the cases that were detected in intensive care units. What concerns me now is that we are trying to keep people out of intensive care units. We are trying to keep people who are elderly and disabled or who need palliative care in a warm and comforting, familiar environment. And so I'm afraid that this could be happening a lot in in-home care or in assisted living, where we just don't have the safeguards and where we can't tell, other than if we have vigilant family members who just say something was not right, something is wrong, this was so unexpected. You know, in hospice care, you are expecting and planning and caring for people who are dying. And so I hope that as a result of this radio show, people who have their families in palliative care and in home care and in assisted care, that they just are vigilant and that they pay attention if they feel that a family member dies or suffers or has a cardiac arrest that is unexpected, that they report it.
I think I have your same fears. I think that's right. More and more care is going into the home, and especially in late in life and terminal care, and I think it's the stage that these people can dance on. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And they've got to be out there. In your studies, were most of these people doctors, nurses, people like respiratory techs or lab techs or other people in the hospital, and are they more male or more female?
Oh, it's so interesting. And, you know, being a nurse educator myself, I'm stressed to say that 85% of the healthcare serial killers were in the domain of nursing. Now, a good third of those nurses were nurses' aides or practical nurses. So it's still distressing, though, to know that two-thirds of the nurses in our study were registered nurses. But then again, registered nurses have access to injectable meds and to intravenous meds, whereas the nurses' aides tended to smother. They tended to suffocate. Some of them put water down the patient's lungs, or they poisoned because nurses' aides don't have access to injectable meds. Then the other, the remaining numbers were doctors. There were quite a few physicians, about 12% physicians, and there was one respiratory therapist and one medical assistant. And then since we published our study, there have been a few other allied health professionals who have been charged. And while the majority of the serial murderers were female, about 40%, men are overrepresented among the nurse serial killers. Only 5 to 12% of nurses are men, and yet quite a few, almost half of the nurse serial murderers were male nurses.
Well, we mentioned insulin and air and succinylcholine, and you talked about more physical things like smothering and whatnot. What are some of the other and more, I guess, interesting or sophisticated or unusual methods or drugs that have been used that did you run across in your study? Or were there any that do these people usually march to the same drummer? Or were there some people who were kind of outliers and used unusual things?
Well, a couple of them used epinephrine, and
you know, I'm not sure why that, you know, why that particular drug was used. Epinephrine is a stimulant. The most common, though, were, as you said, the respiratory paralyzing agents, digoxin, insulin. And insulin is particularly tricky because insulin is not instant, whereas the potassium chloride causes a cardiac arrhythmia. It causes a heart attack. It's pretty much instant. The nurse is still on the scene. But for the nurses who used insulin, their shift may have ended and they had gone home before the patient died. So that was particularly confusing and tricky. And, yeah, I think the most bizarre was the four nurses' aides in Austria who took patients in the nursing home, put a tongue depressor on their tongue, and then took a pitcher of water and poured it down their throats and into their lungs, and they slowly drowned. I mean, that is just so sadistic.
So who are the most likely victims of these people? We had mentioned, you know, obviously people in hospitals are, as you say, not likely to, they're expected to be potential deaths just because they're in a place that you only go to when you're needing, you know, immediate care. So who are the most likely victims just generally within the populations? Are they children, elderly, just anybody, or are they peeking out?
We found that the elderly, the mentally compromised, okay? So people who were mentally disabled or in and out of a coma or had dementia, and certainly children and infants, people who couldn't protest, people who weren't smart enough to figure it out, certainly are vulnerable. But then we had cases like Orville Lynn Majors. Orville Majors was a nurse in Indiana, and his pattern, he picked the patients who he said were whiny and complaining.
Mm-hmm.
And he tended to pick women, female patients, and they almost fit this profile of people that he had deep resentments against. And, you know, that's very disturbing. And then also Richard Angelo. Richard Angelo went beyond injecting patients who might have been in a coma. He injected somebody who, when they performed the code on him, he spluttered and said, "I just watched that nurse inject my line with something that made me stop breathing." I mean, that's a very competent patient. Just to show that they don't only pick on the people who can't report them.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, you noticed in your study that some of these people managed to get away with this for a time, longer than we'd expect. And how did they manage to do that without, I mean, we can see, like, if you're at one hospital and there's a sudden spike, but some of them seem to be able to do this for a while. How do they do that?
Well, this is a very sad statement about the healthcare industry and hospitals. And I actually served on a panel with the American Hospital Association, the National State Boards of Nursing, and the American Association of Nurse Executives. And we were just concerned after Charles Cullen had worked in 9 different hospitals, killing over 40 patients in all of those hospitals, how he was able to get away with it and go on to work somewhere else. So here's often what happens, is that the hospital realizes that they've got a serious problem and that they've got an increased number of patient adverse events associated with the nurse, but they don't have near enough evidence for a criminal case or a prosecution. So what they do is they say, well, we've got enough evidence that bad things are happening to patients when this nurse is here, so we're going to fire them. But, as you know, people have a lot of rights. You can't slander people. You can't libel So what I tell hospitals to do is just say we had an increased number of adverse events and put that in somebody's file and give an honest reference. But employment law is such that it's atypical to give reasons why someone is fired.
Well,
right.
You know, we talk about Michael Swangle. I mean, he was exactly the same thing on the physician side as you were talking about with Cullen. He worked at a lot of different hospitals and moved around. And, you know, in my career, I've had a lot of medical staff positions from chief of medicine, vice chief of staff, sat on many credentials committees. And I know how hard it is to discipline physicians in the first place. And then the state
yep.
medical boards, I think, need to step up and be more aggressive about things. So on the physician side, did your study show anything about how difficult it is? Let's say you have a physician that's been identified that may be involved in this, that, or the other. How difficult is it to bring those people to prosecution?
Very, very difficult. It's, oh my gosh, I've been consulting on a couple of cases that have not yet come to prosecution. And in fact, the healthcare providers who have been associated with adverse patient outcomes have now sued the hospital.
Right.
And, you know, this is just getting really complicated, really sticky, really difficult, because the threshold for prosecution is evidence that shows sort of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's a very high, high, high threshold. And you can't be going around ruining people's careers with suspicions or with, you know, anything short of really good evidence.
Right.
So this continues to be a really problematic area for protecting patients.
Well, I also imagine that part of what is happening also is, like you mentioned, the dispensing machines for medications and controlled substances, but there's also an awful lot of materials that are used in medicine that have the potential to kill that aren't necessarily controlled substances. Is there any realistic way to prevent that kind of abuse by hospital personnel?
Well, more and more of these dispensing machines are not just for narcotics, they're also for routine medications. And what's really triggered this whole reform in medicine has been the Institute of Medicine study that showed the alarming number of medication errors. And so this is a very good movement in the healthcare industry, because the more that errors are prevented and the more that there's accountability for every single dose that's given, the less likely and the less able people who want to run afoul of what is the prescribed dose, it's going to be much, much more harder to get away with that. So I applaud all of the patient safety measures that are now happening as a result of realizing medication errors.
Is there anything the public can do, you know, to get involved in this? You know, we talked about how the medical profession and the hospitals themselves can try to help prevent some of this with the PCSIS system and a lot of other things. What about the public? What message would you want to send out to say, hey, you know, this is what we need to be looking at?
Well, it's the exact same message that I tell the public about being an advocate for their family member when their family member is either in the hospital or in assisted care, and that is be alert, be aware, be the eyes and ears. If your family member's eyes and ears are a little dulled or subdued, pay attention, ask questions, because errors do occur. And then very rarely intentional bad acts do occur. And I think the biggest thing to prevent people and to deter these types of rogue healthcare providers is to have a family member that's very vigilant. And, I mean, I'm sorry to put that additional burden on family members, but I really think it plays a huge role in patient safety.
Well, I don't want us to end today without talking a little bit about your other role beyond that of a researcher into these areas as the Dean of the College of Health and Human Services at CSULA. And you have a fabulous forensic science degree program there, got accredited very quickly for the youth of the program, I'll say. It's part of FEPAC. You've got some great instructors and researchers in that program. So I'm just wondering if you could tell our listeners about forensic science at CSULA and some of the research that's being done there.
Oh, I'm so proud and so delighted of our criminalistics master's program, which is a forensic science master's program. It's the oldest forensic science program west of the Mississippi. It is actually what got me to leave my wonderful job as director of the School of Nursing at San Francisco State University. When I saw the job at Cal State LA, which was a dean, over criminal justice, forensic science, nursing, social work, child family studies, I went, that is my dream job. And they are building the new state-of-the-art crime lab on the campus of Cal State LA that houses the LA County Sheriff Crime Lab, the LA County Police Crime Lab, and it is just a model of research and practice and forensic science where our students get to do internships and our faculty get to do research with practicing criminalists. It is awesome.
Yes, it is. We've been there.
and really some amazing people work there. I know Joe Peterson, who I assume he's still part of the university there.
He did a fabulous study on the rape kit backlog. You know, for all of our listeners who know that there was a backlog of rape kits that had not been analyzed for DNA, because a lot of them, the identity of the perpetrator was not an issue. He and his research team really educated the federal government and certainly the local PD and sheriff as far as what are the odds that these cold case hits might have DNA evidence of random sexual assaults. And, you know, Joe is just an amazing researcher. Don Johnson, Kathy Roberts, and all of our fabulous students. We're in the process of hiring an additional forensic scientist right now, so we look forward to having you back on campus.
Yeah, well, for those of you, I hope you'll support the California Forensic Science Institute that's there on the campus and help this research along. Bea Yorker, thank you so much for joining us today. We really loved having you, really loved learning more about this fascinating topic of medical serial killers. I want to remind our listeners that we'll have additional links, and you can listen to the program anytime, of course, at crimeandscienceradio.com. Thank you to Suspense Radio for being part of this program and producing us as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.